From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Shroud of Turin. Is it real? Here's what's happening. Violent scenes continuing into the night at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, as anti-capitalist protesters set fires after earlier being hit with water cannons and pepper spray by German riot police. Dramatic photos showed helmeted officers battling to keep order after 100,000 protesters poured into the city for their Welcome to Hell protest against the meeting of world leaders. President Trump is there. He will meet tomorrow with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And the Trump administration said it would give diplomacy more time to resolve a gathering crisis over North Korea's efforts to build a nuclear weapon that can reach U.S. shores. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said in his remarks since North Korea launched this week, what American officials concluded was the country's first intercontinental ballistic missile, and the U.S. says that it's not closer to war. Charles R. Smith was with us, expert out there. And he has been saying for weeks now on the program that there will be no major military conflict. I hope you're right, Charles, and it seems so far you are.
Well, the North Koreans operate by a fairly rigorous script to beat the drum, launch a few missiles, set off a couple of firecrackers. They do it on the 4th of July every year and press the international community to send more money. Therefore, they can feed their people. The latest test, the Hwangsong 14, is a bit of a concern here.
Uh-oh.
There's probably more to it than what's being talked about.
Now, when you get concerned, I get concerned. Because you're pretty, most of the time, laid back when it comes to North Korea.
Yeah, well, this new missile, apparently, on closer inspection by intelligence sources, the warhead and the nose cone system appear to be very similar to one deployed by Pakistan.
Oh, boy.
That has been using Chinese technology.
Mm-hmm.
This has been reported by Bill Gertz over in the Washington Times, that the warhead appears to be very similar to the Pakistani Swallow or Aberdeen missile. The concern here is the warhead on the Pakistani missile is not a single warhead. It is a MIRV or a multiple warhead system. So what we may have witnessed was the birth of an intercontinental missile with more than one warhead on it.
And what happens is once the warhead basically separates, these separate little missiles basically take off into all different directions aimed at other cities.
That's pretty much the case. Basically, the third stage, think of it as kind of like a giant school bus, and as it's traveling along, it will drop off its children, in this case in the form of nuclear warheads, at specific bus stops along the way. The problem that we've got here is the warhead and nose cone system, with a resemblance to what's been deployed by Pakistan. This is Chinese technology all the way. Okay, it's been basically shuttled to Pakistan by covert sources, but it is Chinese military technology. It actually resembles very, very closely their Dongfeng 31 system.
Charles, this is the first time I can remember I am sensing a tenseness in your voice over this situation.
Well, the problem that we face here is we're, again, looking at a major escalation of capability. This is not just a, okay, we've just stepped up by deploying a missile that can hit Alaska, not a real big concern, especially with our interceptors. But let's say now we have a missile that can fling not only a warhead, but decoys as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this warhead is also known to be maneuvering.
Are you changing your posture? Are you more concerned now?
I'm more concerned. I don't believe that we are facing a military situation yet. However, this is something that the Trump administration needs to raise with Beijing about their proliferation to Pakistan, North Korea, and Iran of ballistic missile and nuclear weapons technology. This is not exactly a game anymore.
All right, Charles, thank you. This is the first time, folks, I've interviewed Charles for years. He has always been a dove when it comes to this, saying that, you know, don't worry, there's not going to be any conflict. It's just rhetoric from North Korea. This is the first time I sense that he is really getting concerned. An 18-year-old is facing multiple charges, including two felonies, after police say he pulled a shotgun on a woman in the middle of a Daytona Beach road. William Ramey of Ormond Beach was arrested and charged with two counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and one count of possession of pot. Antoinette Saint-Ville told police she was driving in her van with her son. According to the police report, she was slow to go at a green light, and the driver of the truck behind her honked his horn. He then got around her, began shouting at her, taunting her, then got out of his truck and pointed a shotgun at her. That's another worst case of road rage. Dr. Peter Bregan, our resident psychiatrist, what's wrong with Peter? Peter, what's wrong with people?
Well, this guy fits a profile. Most of the road rage people are young people, up to age 39, but the 19-year-olds and younger. They're often doing drugs, including marijuana. Folks, I want to keep reminding you, marijuana is not a harmless drug, often alcohol, and in a sense, it's too much testosterone and too little brain function, in part from immaturity, the brains aren't growing up yet, but also from using drugs. So I think that this ties into a few different social issues. The thing that struck me when I started looking at it again for you is how common it is. I was really overwhelmed by that.
Oh my God, it's everywhere, Peter.
It's everywhere. 80% of people in a recent survey admitted to getting angry behind the wheel. 50% or more talked about doing something aggressive in the past year, like cutting off someone, blocking a car, changing lanes. A full third of people interviewed said they made angry gestures.
Yeah.
It's really quite rampant.
My theory is, and you tell me if you think I'm right or wrong, is that a bad driver or inconsiderate driver does something to a person who is tense, stressed out, having a bad day, whatever, but that person is not having a good time, and he goes ballistic or she goes ballistic. That's my theory of road rage. That's how it happens.
Yeah, except I would modify it in one way, and that is to say a very good driver makes a mistake because it's so easy to make mistakes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Driving. But they do it in front of somebody who's just having a rotten moment.
Well, they're having a rotten moment in part because of their age, in part often because of drugs, but also they tend to be people who blame. So you're just putting yourself in somebody who's one of these shame-driven. I keep wanting to tell folks, beware shame, beware in yourself and others.
Dr. Bregan's website is his last name, BREGGIN.com. Last night when we were on the air, Montana got hit with a 5.8 magnitude earthquake. It is the strongest in 20 years out there. Not a lot of damage, no injuries reported. Cal Ory, author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes. Cal, this was a big one, but you know what? I think we're creeping toward Los Angeles. Something's going to happen here.
I told you 2 weeks ago when I was going up to Canada that I had to come back down through Salt Lake City. Remember I told you that?
Yep.
And you said, well, you'll just report. It'll be exciting. Yellowstone National Park, it covers parts of Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. And all of that lies on top of the supervolcano. So the people were kind of freaking out. 5.8, that's pretty strong.
That is strong.
We had that in Tahoe at the end of December. It's strong. And the epicenter was only 230 miles from Yellowstone. My theory is, though, the government's not going to tell us. They really aren't until it's too late. Like, I was just reading, like, 24 hours, if they really know something's coming down. But it'll be way too late. Chaos, panic. They don't want to ruin tourism. They don't want to cause chaos and panic and have the real estate plummet. Why? Because oftentimes these swarms, and there are over 1,000 now up there, in the whole vicinity, it's all linked. A lot of times it fizzles. And so why ruffle everyone's feathers? But I'm sure the locals and the tourists aren't real happy up there. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I'm just concerned, Cal, that, we're heading for a big one somewhere, whether it's Yellowstone or the West Coast. It's out there. It's just creeping around. Thank you so much, Cal Lurie. When I was 21 years old, I picked up a book called Journeys Out of the Body by Robert Monroe and a fellow by the name of Charles Tart. It was an amazing book about astral projection. I couldn't put it down. As a matter of fact, I've been using that book all my life in my broadcast career as I talk about OBEs and things like that. Up next, Charles Tart joins us on Coast to Coast as we talk about parapsychology next. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Charlie Tart, PhD, was with us about 6 years ago on Coast to Coast, internationally known for psychological work on the nature of the human mind, particularly altered states of consciousness. As one of the founders of the field of transpersonal psychology and for his research in parapsychology, his primary goal is to build bridges between the scientific and spiritual communities, and not a lot of scientists do that, and to help bring about a refinement and integration of Western and Eastern approaches for knowing the world and for personal and social growth. My pleasure to bring back to Coast to Coast, Charlie Tart. Charlie, always a pleasure. Good to have you back. It's been a while.
It's a pleasure to be here, George, and I was excited to hear you mention Bob Monroe's Journeys Out of the Body book. That's a fantastic book, isn't it?
Oh, my God, I love that book, and just to realize that you had a part of that.
I'll tell you a funny story about that.
Okay.
Bob Monroe was an ordinary American businessman who started having out-of-the-body experiences, so of course he went to his doctor to be cured, but the doctor couldn't do much. But he then finally decided he should write it up and try to get it published as a book, and he sent it off to an agent in New York who didn't do anything with it. So finally I said, let me send it to my editor at Doubleday and see what happens. Well, that my editor got it, he took it home, and he read the story about Bob Monroe's out-of-the-body experiences until he came to the chapter on how to do it, at which point he closed the manuscript because he was afraid it might work.
It was just an amazing, I mean, 21 years old when I read it, Charles, when it came out. It changed my whole direction of thinking. My aunt, who was a doctor of psychiatry, Dr. Shafika Karegula. I don't know if you ever came across her.
Oh, yeah, you know, I remember some of her stuff years ago.
She wrote a book called Breakthrough to Creativity. She was into ESP and telepathy and things like that. So all this was coming at me at a young age, and I just digested it. So it's great to know that you were part of that. It's also great to know that you as a scientist are in this direction, because a lot of scientists don't want to talk about this. You know that.
Yeah, I know it.
And you wrote a book with our friend, the late Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, too, didn't you?
I put a chapter in one of his books, yeah, but okay. I wouldn't give myself too much credit.
All right, let us get into some things here that have to do with what this is all about, first of all. I mean, you have been studying this for years. You're a very accomplished researcher and author. There's something very special and unusual about us as human beings, but something in the cosmos. There's something going on. People call it a God connection. What do you think this is that allows our mind, our consciousness, to function the way it does?
Yeah, that's a good one, George. I wish I could really answer it, but
I wish you could too.
We'll work around it a little bit.
All right.
You might say, to oversimplify, there are really kind of two views of what human life is and what our purpose in the universe is and so forth. And one of them is the old one that various religions have that, yeah, we've got a physical body and all that, but there's something spiritual or something not the same as the physical. And that's connected with higher purposes, God, mysticism, and whatnot. And then there's the modern scientific view, which has morphed over from a strictly scientific view into a scientistic view. And what I mean by that is that science is supposed to be a continual search for getting better and better understandings of things. You don't find truth in science. You find a way that is useful to explain things and let you work with them, but then you wonder, could it be a little more accurate, or is there a different way of doing it? But when your explanations start to become automatic ways of thinking, they become sort of like a dogmatic religion. Sociologists years ago coined the term scientism. You know, you take the science of the time and it starts becoming an unquestionable doctrine. I got a question for you. When you were a kid taking science classes in school, did anybody ever teach you about the theory of gravity?
No.
No, they taught you about the law of gravity.
The law of gravity.
Right. Yeah. Well, wait a minute. When did gravity become a law? Was there a meeting of the Cosmic Assembly or something? It's just an illustration that we stop really thinking about something and get stuck in a certain way. Now, we get stuck on something that works. That's good. But to stay stuck there forever, not so good. My big concern is that this view that the mind is nothing but the action of the brain, and of course you're going to die and the brain's going to rot and that's the end of it, that kind of takes an awful lot of meaning out of life.
It sure does.
Yeah.
And, you know, raw science will tell you, when you die, that's it. There's no life after death. The brain stops to function, and that's it.
Yeah, I got a picture of a decomposing brain I use in lectures sometimes. Pretty disgusting.
It is
disgusting. It's not science that tells us that. It's scientism. It's the physical sciences have been incredibly successful, you know, and I love it. I'm a gadgeteer. That's great. But they forget that this is just the best we can do at the moment, and we got to keep looking at stuff.
Charlie, what was it that got you, as a scientist, convinced that this other part of it exists?
Well, you know, I was very lucky that way. I was raised as a Lutheran, you know. My grandmother took me to church. You know, grandmothers spoil you rotten, you know.
They do. That's what they're for.
For her, it was good enough for me. And then by the time I got to be a teenager, two things happened. One is that I noticed that the adults in this church were pretty hypocritical about what they actually practiced. I mean, teenagers are very good at spotting that sort of stuff. And also, I'd really fallen in love with science and read lots of stuff, and so I saw stuff that claimed to be scientific that said religion is all nonsense. It's all an illusion. And I thought, well, yeah, that's too bad if it is, but they certainly have a lot of instances of crazy stuff coming out of religion. But very luckily, I came across books about parapsychology and psychical research, as it used to be called in the old days. And it said, you know, stuff happens to human beings that doesn't fit into this model that it's nothing but the brain, that it's nothing but material. We have evidence that the mind can do things that matter as we know it can't do. So let's be more open to the spiritual. That doesn't mean go out and believe anything that's labeled spiritual or religious. Lots of nonsense there, like in all areas of human life. But I think we could become more sensible about religion and the spiritual. We could test various aspects of spirituality and say, yeah, this is all right if you believe it, but it doesn't work except under certain conditions, and here's a better way of understanding it. I'd like to see people being able to be trained to have deep religious, deep spiritual experiences themselves, you know?
Sure.
I don't want to be good because somebody threatens me with hell if I'm not good. I'd much prefer to be good because I've known directly the kind of mystical experiences that say we're actually a part of something greater, and of course we're related. If I hurt you, I'm hurting me, so it's only sensible to be more decent. I'd like people to have those direct experiences, not just be preached at.
Charlie, do you think people are generally born good and then become bad?
I think for the most part, but, you know, it's hard to tell. You know, a lot of our Western religions started out with an idea of original sin, and, you know, that's something of a downer. You know, sir, no matter how hard I try, I'm basically flawed.
From the get-go, and you didn't have anything to do with it. Charlie, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, then we will be right back. Charlie Tart with us. You should see all his works, and his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Our luncheon series is off and running, and next Tuesday with Catherine Austin Fitz, who's coming into town. As a matter of fact, she's going to be our live studio guest on Monday night. And then her luncheon is Tuesday, July 11th in Los Angeles. If you'd like to come by, send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Don't call the restaurant because they'll just refer you back to this email. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. Include your phone number and they will send you some information. Come on by and see Catherine Austin Fitz. And those of you who'd love to see Karen Dahlman with her Ouija board, I'm going to put her at the other end of the table. That is Tuesday, July 25th. Same thing. Send an email to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Charlie Tart, as we talk about his work, his research. We're into the realm of parapsychology. Charlie, you were brought up a Lutheran, and you know that formed a foundation for you. What about most scientists? Aren't they brought up that way too, and then something changes?
Well, I don't know if it's most, but certainly a lot of them had a conventional religious thing. But a lot of people turn against religion. You know, they pray to God to cure a sick loved one, and the person dies, and they get pissed off, and you know, and whatnot. There are a lot of individual reasons for that, and that's a shame, really, because a lot of our strength and power and meaning is tied up in spiritual kind of stuff. And if we deny it wholesale, we lose it. We can't touch it. That's a shame. Well, you were talking about truth in the break a few minutes ago. I want to link that back to Bob Monroe that you mentioned at the beginning. Again, for anybody who tuned in late, Bob Monroe was a businessman who started having lots of out-of-the-body experiences. And he eventually started writing books and holding classes to try to teach other people.
Well, they still have the Monroe Institute going.
Yeah, they still have it, right? I mean, you know, he had a very sensible attitude. He says, look, I know you'll think I'm crazy for saying this is what happened, but here's how you can try it yourself. Maybe it'll work for you. And I would go to some of his classes sometimes. We were friends for many years. And I could see, though, that people wouldn't just accept these are my experiences. They wouldn't just accept his reporting the truth as it happened to him. They wanted to make him into a guru or a spiritual teacher. And he wouldn't do it. He'd say, no, I'm sorry. I don't have direct cosmic truth on this particular one. This is what happened, and I think it means this, but you have to work it out for yourself. That's a very important attitude. I try to do that in my own teaching. You know, I do this webinar a few times a year on mindfulness and meditation, and I see how sometimes people try to make me into a guru. No, I don't have any monopoly on spiritual truth. I've got a lot of information, and it works pretty well in some ways. But if the students don't ask any questions and they just think I'm just teaching them the truth, boy, I'm going to be disappointed and bored.
Why does it seem that meditation is a jump start for a lot of this? Out of body, telepathy, ESP, psychic abilities. It seems like when you meditate, you tend to have more abilities that way.
Yeah. It's lots of things, but I think one of them is that in our normal life anymore, we're so darned busy. It's like you have no moments to notice what's going on in your experience and maybe thinking, that's an interesting feeling. I wonder if I could explore that or develop it or something. And at least one of the most common things is meditation is you sit still and keep your mouth closed for a while and pay attention to your internal experience, and that creates a chance for something to happen.
And you know, Charlie, religion teaches, and you touched on this a little bit before the break, you know, that you know, you're going to go to hell if you're bad, but there is evil out there, isn't there?
It sure seems that way.
I mean, we witness it every day.
Yeah.
But I mean, on the other side, the spiritual side, as I'll call it for now, there is evil on that other side, isn't there?
Well, that's a tough one, George, and it's one I have a tough problem with, okay? Some people certainly do things that are disgusting and awful and evil, and I try to remember that people who have far deeper spiritual experiences than me say, actually, we're all children of God, we're all connected and all that, and these people are just, their connection is very poor. I hope that's all there is to it, you know, so that if they could kind of wake up and realize what they're doing, they wouldn't be like that. I hope there aren't actively evil things out there, but I don't know, and I know I don't want there to be. But then, you know, I look at my cat. I love to rub my cat and whatnot, but other times I'm glad I'm a heck of a lot bigger than him because he kills things for a living. Me, I just buy the stuff at the supermarket, so I don't realize that I'm responsible for it, too. But it's tough.
Yeah, it sure is tough. There's no question about that. But the individual who's despicable in human life and commits crimes and murders against other individuals, when he or she dies, why should they be put into the same pool as someone who was a great person, a nice person in their physical life?
Well, I certainly don't think they should be, but I don't know how it works, you know, and this is one of the reasons I try to promote scientific research here. We have a lot of opinions on what happens to people after death, and some of those might be genuine insights into what actually goes on. And a lot of it might be our wishes projected out into the universe. You know, I was raised as such and such a person, and my religion says so and so. And we can fool ourselves. But one of the virtues of science is you try to figure out how to get at stuff without fooling yourself. And actually, you know, science, that's a virtue of common sense, you know. If you realize you can fool yourself, but you'd really like to get a better idea of what's actually going on, you've already taken a step forward to getting a better understanding.
Is it easy or difficult, Charlie, based on the people that you've dealt with, to get into this state, to be able to understand what the other side is all about, and to be able to do things that could better your life by tapping into consciousness and things like that?
There's such big differences on that, George. I mean, I've met people who they were exposed to 5 minutes of meditation instructions. They had a life-changing experience. You know, the near-death experiences are pretty good that way, but I never recommend them because the near part is tricky.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've met other people, you know, who it just doesn't seem to work. For years, for instance, I tried to learn how to meditate, and I got instructions from very good meditation teachers and all that. And meditation for me meant sitting there, having a lot of aches and pains, my mind racing like mad, feeling guilty that something better shouldn't happen. I finally gave it up because I said, you know, there must be a special talent that it takes for meditation. I guess I and some people don't have it. Luckily, I met a meditation teacher, Shinzen Young, years later, who taught it in a way that suddenly made sense to me. And now I meditate because I like to meditate, and sometimes I learn some things too. But I don't think that just because I'm meditating, I always get the truth, okay? This is something I'm thinking a lot about. We can create experiences that feel very real, and then we assume that's the way the universe is, but they may not be real. Or they might be, but they need to be tested. That's the beauty of science for me. You know, I'm what I might call a thoughtaholic. I love to have clever thoughts, and I feel so smart and whatnot. But the beauty of science is that it says, well, when you have this wonderful explanation, you got to test it to see if it really works.
Are you totally convinced that life after death continues?
No.
You aren't? What percent?
In my last book on this, The End of Materialism, which incidentally is coming out as a paperback very quickly, I put survival of death among what I called the many maybes, you know. I listed some things like telepathy and remote viewing and stuff as stuff that was so well proven that anybody who says there's no evidence for it is just ignorant. But survival, I haven't made up my mind. The evidence is good for it, and it's also very tricky sort of stuff. So, you know, I fall back on the old thing of we need more research. Who can quarrel with that sort of thing? But a lot of people that I respect are certainly convinced that there is survival. I live my life as if there's some kind of survival after death, and the quality of that life would depend on what we do in this life. Now,
right.
That has two effects. One, it's going to make my dying much more interesting if I think this is a transition instead of this is the final failure. But on the other hand, if there really is no survival of death, I'm not going to be embarrassed afterwards that I was wrong.
I'm reading a book on Frank Sinatra's life. I just want to learn more about this guy. And all his friends, the Rat Pack members, they're all dead. They're all dead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you for a moment you think, this is it. You have your life. It's a good run. Then it's over. And, you know, it's for the living. But there's that part of me that keeps coming back that says, nope, there's something more to this. Because there's so many unusual things happening. People are seeing things, witnessing things, feeling things in their dream state. There's got to be more than this.
Yeah.
And then I come down to this common denominator, Charlie, and that is, why are we even here in the first place? This is not a fluke. There's got to be some design behind it. And if there is, it's a total design, and that includes the other side. And that's why I'm convinced that it exists.
Yeah. I'm not going to quarrel with you in the least, George. You know, one of the things we human beings need is meaning. Just like we need vitamins or we get vitamin deficiency diseases, if the world, if our life stops making any sense to us, it has bad effects on us. I think a lot of people commit suicide or something like that. If you just take this, it's all meaningless, you know, a bunch of molecules bumped into each other for a few million years and by chance they're here and it doesn't mean a damn thing. That I guess some people manage to still find some good meaning in life in spite of that. But to me, that sure makes it hard. Whereas if what you do now is going to count long term, that's a lot more inspiring to me.
What have you concluded about out-of-body experiences at this point?
Well, they're real in the sense that the experience happens to people, okay, and it's quite distinct from a dream or just imagining stuff and so forth. When people ask me what an out-of-the-body experience feels like, I say, well, it feels like just now in terms of the way your mind works. You know, you can think, you can remember things, but you happen to realize you're someplace else than where your physical body is, which is kind of unusual. But are you really out there? Sometimes... yeah, I think you are. Monroe used to worry about this, you know. He'd have out-of-the-body experiences, and as he kidded me once, you know, I find myself out of my body, and I'm standing on a street corner in some city I don't recognize, and 2 minutes later it's over. How the hell do I know if that's real? But sometimes you see things happening at a distance, and you know there's something psychic about it. It's not just imagination.
Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Charlie Tart, questions and stories. I'd love to hear your out-of-body experiences and stories like that that have come our way. Why hasn't science, real science, investigated these things, Charlie? Major studies and things like that. It just isn't happening.
Insecurity, I think.
Really?
Yeah. Don't you want to feel that you've been successful in your career?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay. There are things that make you successful in science, and that's discovering things and working with things that are accepted as the best truth we have. And then along come nuts like me who say, hey, we're missing something really major. Oh, get out of that. I had a professor who used to say, this was back in graduate school, you know, it's only been 100 years since they let us out of the philosophy department, and if we're not careful, they'll take away our white lab coats and send us back to the philosophy department. Psychologists particularly tend to be kind of insecure about, are we really being scientific? Well, avoiding anything that's controversial is not the way to prove that we're sensible and we're really open-minded.
Tell me about the Archives of Scientists Trends Transcendent Experiences. What is that?
Oh, yeah. This is a website I started years ago. I've lectured a lot on psychic stuff and mystical stuff and so forth and written about it. And a lot of times I hear from people who tell me about some psychic or mystical experience they've had, and they add, and I've never told anybody else in the world about it because I know I'll be laughed at or they'll think I'm crazy. But they realize I was a safe person to tell it to. So I decided to really push on that for scientists, and just using some contacts I had, I ended up getting, 80 or 90 scientists to write about experiences they had that were first-class psychic or spiritual sorts of experiences. But here's the interesting thing about that. I told them they could write me about their experiences and they could be anonymous. I would know who they were because I wanted to make sure it was genuine, but nobody else would. They could choose anonymity. Only about half of them chose anonymity. But the ones who used their real names were almost all retired, so they didn't have to worry about what their neighbors and colleagues
Yeah, called. No repercussions there.
Yeah. That's sad. I mean, it's funny, but it's sad.
I just, when I interview scientists, the few of them who are really into this, like you are, I think it's refreshing. And it's just so important to get the word out about this, don't you think?
Yeah. I sometimes think it's a calling for me. You know, I've made a lot less money. I had made a lot less progress than if I'd stayed in a conventional thing because you get punished for daring to have an interest in this. But, hey, this is important and exciting. I'm very glad to have gotten the stuff out.
Absolutely, to be sure. Charlie, your websites, of course, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. How many books have you written?
I've written about a dozen books so far, and as I mentioned earlier, my last one, The End of Materialism, which is about what psychic stuff means for spirituality, is just coming out in paperback. There's a link on one of the websites where people can pre-order it.
Yeah, a lot of your books, Transpersonal Psychologies, Altered States of Consciousness, those were, one of them was back in the 70s, wasn't it? Altered States, I think.
1969 was Altered States, yeah.
Wow. That goes way back.
And that actually helped an awful lot of people who'd had strange experiences, and now they said, wait a minute, look at this book. I wasn't necessarily crazy for having this experience. There's a name for it. We know something about it. Wow. I still get thank you letters 40, 50 years later from people who said that book helped me relax about my life so much.
What do you think of reincarnation?
I'm all in favor of it. I like life. It's confusing as hell, but fascinating to learn. I got to repeat this course a few times in order to get what it is.
Until you reach perfection, and then you stop coming back.
Well, I don't want to stay away from perfection. I think perfection is liable to turn into a state of your ego blown up to infinity.
Well, let me rephrase what I mean by perfection. Total goodness. You have no evil in you at all. You're just very, very enlightened as a being.
Yeah.
That to me is perfection. The heavenly state.
Yeah. And I work at it, but I'm not very good at it. But I'm, you know, reincarnation would obviously be useful to learn that. Now, that's a kind of Western view. You know, the traditional Eastern views is that reincarnation is a curse because we carry our bad habits with us. We get in the same sorts of trouble over and over again. And so you may suffer in this life and the next life and 10,000 more before you wise
up. Yeah, until you wise
up.
That's.
But I think it's an opportunity.
Charles, we're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls, questions, and also stories. Folks, if you've had OBEs or anything spiritual or unusual, check in with us. We'd love to hear the story.
One of the perks of being a Coast Insider is that you can participate in our twice-monthly live chat sessions or read the transcripts later. George Norrie chats with insiders on the second Tuesday of the month, and a special guest is featured later in the month. Click the Coast Insider link on coasttocoastam.com to get started.